Welcome to Archetypes and the Planets, where Jenny Montgomery and I, Bea Gonzalez, invite you to think metaphorically as we explore how we have collectively translated the map of the sky into our mythologies, religious systems, and personal psychology. Okay, hello, Jenny. How are you doing?
Hi, Bea. I'm really well today, and I'm so excited that you got me to reread Wuthering Heights and go back to the amazing story of the Brontes.
They are amazing. I mean, they're very tragic in their own way, but their whole story is it's one of those that you couldn't make up because it wasn't one, but the entire family dynamic is so, it's incredible. And also the time that they were writing and what they wrote. And the reason I wanted you to go back to that was actually because of what you recommended to me, which is the Donald Cowshed book, which we discussed in our previous episode. And the reason I was reading it and I was thinking the whole notion of how trauma is very much tied to relationship, which we know, you don't have to read too much or live too much to know that. But his particular tying of those demonic figures that enter into our consciousness to protect us at the beginning, but then they turn against us and they stop our individuation. And I kept thinking Heathcliff. I kept thinking that is such an interesting animus relationship, an animus representation, probably one of the best. And then the next thing, and see what you think about this, that I thought about was Jung's idea about art and how there are two types of art, psychological art, and then there's visionary art. And when I think of the great female writers of the 18th, 19th centuries, I think obviously the first, Jane Austen, I consider her a psychological, social type of writer. She is great at defining the networks that happen, the society of the time, even and the psychological, the interior lives to some degree of the people involved. But you get to the Brontes, and I think, and this was argued by Barbara Hannah, I completely agree. You look at something like Wuthering Heights, and that is a visionary work of art. Okay, good. I'm glad we're...
Yeah, it could be a fairy tale. It could be a myth. It has structural elements. It has character. It has plot that, it doesn't match at all with that ladylike Victorian fiction the time.
And of course, what's interesting is they had to disguise the fact that they were women writers when they sent off the work. And then there was a little bit of a backlash when they realized that these women were writing about these passions, which is so interesting. And the other reason I think they're really particularly interesting is Barbara Hannah makes the point that Jung never really got the animus right because he never really understood the inner masculine as well as maybe these three writers did. And the reason is they were women working with these inner figures, trying to understand it, and that you might see the best representations. And in particular, I would think Wuthering Heights. Heathcliff is a particularly interesting inner figure. Rochester as well, but I would say that one, in my mind anyway, is much more, I would say unedited, raw. There's something about Heathcliff that is very much about that. And the reason I thought about this, by the way, too, is that this keeps coming up. There is currently a new version of this on Netflix, which is based on a best-selling novel written by an Italian author with a pseudonym that's very interesting. It's Erin Doom is the pseudonym she chose. And she wrote this book called The Tearsmith, which has been turned into a Netflix series. You know how they do that. And I thought that had a Heathcliff, it echoed the same thing, obviously not with the skill level, I think anyway, that Bronte did, but the same thing, this idea of this dark male figure, and in this case they both come out of a traumatic situation. They're in an orphanage, and I think it's worth, if people are interested in Wuthering Heights, just to see how that the relationship between these new versions of the same old stories. So let's start with you.
That there are also these shadows in this Gothic fiction. There are hauntings, there is mention of vampires, we have there is that sort of attempt, I think, of the quote unquote modern woman, as Jung referred to the problem of the modern woman, trying to grapple with the new configuration of the inner world. Right. And you can interpret these novels in so many ways. You could say, okay, we can look at this from the gender perspective, the class perspective, religious perspective, even there are racial elements in these books. But yes. I think, psychologically, there is so much taking place for women, especially who have access to education at this time. Right. And the Bronte sisters are educated alongside their Their father is a, what is he, a parson?
Preacher, yes.
Preacher. Yeah, he's educated at Cambridge. And there is yeah, this, but not very much scope for the women to extend themselves in the external world or to understand who they are. But they're exposed to a lot of writing, to Byron, to, you know, fiction and periodicals that are coming into the house, and to the even the idea of the vampire is something that they both
Yeah,
know and that they both refer to in their
right.
novels.
This is so interesting, by the way. And I'm put up, we're sharing the screen just so you can see it. The discovery of Neptune happens in 1846, which aligns perfectly with the work that we're doing. And Neptune, Karen LeGrice, I don't know which one book he mentions this, but he says that there is the word unconscious first shows up in a textbook at around 1846. It coincides very much with the discovery of Neptune. And if you look, I mean, first of all, what I find interesting about the discovery of Neptune is there's a Neptune exact conjunction with Saturn at 25 degrees Aquarius. It's almost like we measured Neptune. We found a way to locate it and put it somewhere. And the reason I bring up the Neptune is I really think that there, and what's interesting beyond the discoveries, by 1847, you have the first actual vampire story being published. I just checked this and I thought it was called Varney, Varney, the Vampire, or Feast of Blood. And it's published actually in 1845. So just before this, and this is maybe why it's showing up that these young women are actually very well read. And their father, as you say, it's very striking. He decides he's not going to discriminate between Branwell, the brother, and them. And so they're aware of it. But I think it's interesting that this comes up. And then I just had this intuition. And the reason the vampire word comes a lot in my mind, because I do think there's an element of that in Heathcliff. And I remember hearing Miriam Woodman, the Jungian analyst, talk about the disturbing rise of vampire romances that were happening. Do you remember this in the 90s with Anne Rice? And she thought that that was like the part of yourself that was a critical part that was basically draining the life out of you. And so I thought, I got to look at Anne Rice's chart because Anne Rice was the creator of this. And I remember specifically hearing her say that she had fallen in love with her own creation, which as a writer, as a novel writer or a novelist, I found that odd because I'm not quite sure I ever fallen in love with any of my creations.
Isn't that
But
amazing?
yeah, it's like, what interesting.
It reminds me of Catherine's Rhapsody in Wuthering Heights, where she says, you know, Heathcliff is me.
Me, yes.
I am Heathcliff.
A total identification with the other, which really signals how much that is her. Often I get the question all the time, who are you basing your characters on, in your novels? And it's like, well, nobody. They're interior figures. They're the dialogue I am having with myself. And I believe this is probably what's going on with most authors. So I just checked quickly on Rice's chart. And I found that the Neptune, of course, is wired in into a chart, as is Pluto, because I think the vampire also has a bit of a Pluto vibe to it for sure, right? It has this idea of death, of something attracting you into your own. And so
And
she
look
has both
here
that.
at the aspect of Neptune also in a partile in conjunct with Mars in its own bound. So, you know, this is, and just this week, coincidentally, I was doing some work and looking at some alchemical images, and I was looking at Robert Fludd's beautiful image. It's called The Rose Gives the Bee Honey, or Dat Rose Mel Apibum, right? So the beautiful rose mandala and this bees, and the bees are taking the honey from the rose. But in the background, there is a sort of a fence with spider webs and spiders. And it's so interesting because it's showing almost the shadow side of this sustenance. And if we loop back around to Khalshed, discussing how the traumatized soul can engender these protective, both protective and persecutory, but that the persecutory can show up as a paralyzing force. And that's exactly what the spider does. And it's exactly what the vampire is related to the spider in the sense that it injects this poison, creates this paralysis. So the victim is unable to move and yet is observing, their own demise, the sucking of their lifeblood. And that's
That's
some,
wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I hadn't heard that, and that's great. I've never heard of the relationship between the spider and the vampire, but once you said it, of course, that's exactly what happens. You're caught. And in a way, that is what happens in Wuthering Heights. These two are caught in a kind of web. They can't escape each other. And that's what makes it compelling, I think, to the viewer, because I think we all have an inner figure at some point. And of course, the work of our lives is to differentiate that so that we don't get overwhelmed by one side or the other. But you see it in a very pure, raw form. And I keep thinking, she was writing this in her late 20s. So this is like her Saturn return story, right? And just had this incredible ability to key in to that inner world in a way that, and in fact, from what I read of their biography, in her case, she was of the sister, she was the one that was least able to relate to the outer world. So there's almost a sense that there is a price to be paid, that if you are having this kind of inner conversation, the outer world becomes a bit of a problem. It's harder to relate to that side of things, the extroverted side.
Yes, and in the Animus, Volume One, Barbara Hannah draws some parallels, or she discusses Emily Bronte in parallel to some of the female saints
Yes.
and their otherworldly personas and behavior.
Yeah, Santa Teresa de Avila, who had absolute mystical, almost erotic, I mean, the Bernini statue gets that so right, has all this incredibly erotic poetry.
Yes, and how, and Hannah mentions how Avila's writings were heavily edited because this material was supposedly not fit for civilized consumption. And then we discover that Charlotte Bronte destroyed an entire novel
Yes,
that Emily
that
Bronte.
isn't that. I know, as a writer, don't you just go, "Oh, why did you do that, Charlotte?" Charlotte seemed to be the one that I had was probably closest to the sensation function. She handled everything. She made sure that she organized the sisters as the eldest, and she did unfortunately do something that is tragic, which is she did burn the second novel. We would have had another novel from Emily Bronte, which I'm sure we would all would have been interested in seeing just what was in
So
there.
what are the possibilities there? Was it too erotic? Was it too
Yes.
out there? Was it
Right.
too good? What
Right.
is
That's an interesting, that last one is interesting. I wonder if it was maybe too erotic because although, Charlotte Bronte doesn't shy away from writing pretty intense relationship stories herself. I mean, within the confines of what she could do at that period, in that period, right? But I'm really intrigued. When I read that, I felt sad because I thought, wow, that would have been such an interesting thing because it would have been also the development of her as a writer, right? It was a novel that came after Wuthering Heights. And then, of course, she died tragically so young that we wouldn't know anything after that. But yeah, no, it's really interesting the connection between the vampire, the animus, and I think trauma. I think these are all now. It's interesting because we do have to talk about Bramwell. He is the brother who is involved in this. And I think what you were saying is so important that the fact that the father allowed them to have the education that was denied to a lot of women at the time, and that they themselves created worlds from very young where they would talk to each other and that they would actually get together in the evenings around the dinner table and read to each other their work. But by that point, Bramwell had basically been excluded. He was considered the real genius of the family, but he became an ad, he became addicted to alcohol after he had this affair with the appropriately named
This
older
is
woman
Robert.
called Mrs. Robinson. I know some things are impossible to make up. But then he descended into horrible addiction, and then he's the first who dies of TB. And shortly after, it's Emily and then Anne, all almost in a row within about 6 months. But he's a tragic figure within that whole family, in that they all felt he had this great potential, and yet they were living it out for him because he was incapable. And what's interesting about that is that he has the addiction. That is the shadow quality too, by the way, of this whole story that's in here. There is an addictive relationship happening between Heathcliff and Catherine. They cannot separate, right?
And
So
there's
it's
explicitly drawn picture of addiction in Hindley,
rest.
Catherine's brother. So
Oh
we get to
yes,
see the Bramwell's dissipation,
right.
depicted right in.
Right.
And again with Kalshed, and he when he discusses the daimon, so he doesn't call it the demon lover, he says the daimon lover.
Yeah.
And I've never looked at the etymology of that word before, but daimon means to divide,
Oh,
and
interesting.
it's fascinating. So it's like this dissociated or split off, the personified split off
Right.
aspect of spirit that can come in, in different forms, in a diabolic personification, self-attack, And I know Charlotte Bronte was, terribly hard on herself, and she had this weird delusion that she was incredibly ugly.
Right.
And people, if someone looked at her, they would, avert their eyes, thereafter, because she was so hideous, which wasn't true apparently.
Right.
And yeah, that these characters like Heathcliff or the vampiric figure are, yeah, and Marianne Woodman, most, in Addiction to Perfection, lays the whole thing out so clearly.
Yes.
So that's why this is such a groundbreaking work for so many women.
Yeah.
First, it was first suggested that I read that by an astrologer.
Oh, interesting.
So
So it was
it's
coming through,
absolutely,
yeah.
you cannot read that book as a woman and come away the same because
Yeah.
of that, yeah, because of that depiction of that attacking animus that is so diabolical.
I think the reason that Woodman was particularly good at this is she was an English teacher all her life, married to a Blake scholar. And so a lot of her life was, and this goes back to how literature often points things out in a way that even a history that someone gives you, an analytical history, is sometimes not as good because you're really entering the world of these inner figures, right? In a way that is, so when you talked about Charlotte Bronte and Mr. Rochester, there's another animist figure who is cold, detached, and she is presented as someone who is unappealing, unattractive. I mean, you really see her story. But you also see that Neptune, by the way, in that, by the end, she's hearing voices. They hear each other. There's this kind of otherworldly connection that they all seem to have. Heathcliff as well, with and it's just
She's haunted by the uncle in the very beginning. The
Yes.
terrifying, yeah.
Yes. So there is a connection to the unconscious that is showing up. And I'm very interested in this personally because as an undergraduate and graduate student, my studies weren't only history, they always included literature. And I was particularly fascinated by Dostoevsky. And Dostoevsky publishes his first novel in 1846, just at the time with
Oh
these
my God.
women, The Double, which, by the way, is an incredible story for already telling you that I've always said depth psychology needed people like Dostoevsky and the Brontes because they were articulating what the depth psychologists would do 50 years later. The other person who's online at this time started the Ring Cycle is Wagner, which is an incredible also interior journey. And he starts at around the same time, 1847. It takes him 25 years, but that's the beginning, the genesis of this incredible interior work that will actually be used then by a lot of depth psychologists to talk about, yes, these are just because they're fairy tales, right? At the end of the
And
day,
that's
these are all
such
fairy
a
tales.
Saturn Neptune phrase is what, how did you say it? The work, the inner work,
The inner work, yeah.
the opening up of the unconscious, but then the Saturn is the working,
Work.
it's the
Yes.
cooking of it,
Yes, that's
in
why I love the fact that when it was cited for the
yeah.
first time, you have these two, an exact conjunction. They're exactly the same space in the sky, which seems to me that the way to Neptune is through Saturn. And maybe the way through Saturn is through Neptune. I don't know. But both of them seem to have a connection to each other. And it's interesting because Liz Green would later on in her book on Neptune comment that a lot of artists have that combination of Saturn-Neptune square, especially because you're trying to bring the formless into form, which is Saturn.
Into form,
So,
and you can't
yeah.
do it without discipline. You can't do it
No.
without showing up.
Yeah, a
And
lot of
so,
work.
yeah, and
Yeah.
Saturn Neptune is also a really good signature for the Gothic.
Yes.
It's sort of dark, but also diaphanous. It's the opening
Yes.
of the unconscious, but it's actually knocking on the walls,
Yes. And I love it because, Saturn is what we fear. And the Gothic, I think the reason it appeals to some degree is there's an element of danger. You're reading it and you think, oh, And there's an element of danger also to Wuthering Heights. You have that first opening scene where there's this ghost coming through the window, and this poor man who's staying there as a guest suddenly gets introduced to this crazy story about Catherine and Heathcliff. So you get this feeling of the supernatural erupting, but in ways that can be frightening. It's because it's not just pretty. Neptune is a place where, as a planet, I think it has an element of, because the unconscious can be a scary place, you have no control over it. It can be overwhelming. That's the thing that Neptune does. And I think that's why it's also associated with addiction. It's the idea that you can be overwhelmed and cannot structure your life in any way to be able to oppose it. So it has that element of danger, but I think that's also its appeal. Like, that's why we read it. That's why
Oh
we.
my gosh. I'm just remembering the dream. It was one of Emily's dreams that Barbara Hannah talks about
Oh, the
where
baby. Is it the baby?
she's under the sea. She's
Oh.
actually under the ocean, under the floor of the sea
Right.
in a castle or something like that. And she feels the entire weight of the ocean above her head.
Wow.
And then like the walls start to to break.
Collapse, right? Isn't that a Saturn Neptune story? And she was writing that just as that planet was showing itself in the sky. One of the things I think all of us who study astrology are always quite amazed by are these synchronicities that occur that you wouldn't notice unless you're paying attention. You think, wow, that work, it is so emblematic of the Saturn Neptune story. I was thinking actually of Charlotte's dream, where she has a dream where she's carrying around a baby all the time and is worried about taking care of it. And I think, wow, I mean, the way she died at 39, now believed by, I was reading that a scholar at the University of London, where I went, he looked at the records and said, she didn't die of TB. She died of extreme morning sickness that wasn't treated properly when she was very early in her pregnancy. And she might have been weakened by TB, but the fact is that's what they're now attributing her death to. So she actually died pregnant from this excessive vomiting, which, by the way, is very serious unless it's treated. And I guess at the time, as we know, childbirth was a very dangerous affair in all aspects of it. But her dream was that one. It was a recurring, very haunting dream of holding a baby and not knowing who it was. And basically, this baby haunted her. So it's so fascinating. But do you want to look at maybe we'll look at the charts a little bit more and just look at the time period when these works were and their charts, because I think they're quite interesting. You want to share your screen?
So the Brontes, their lifespans really cover the birth and the florescence of Gothic fiction. So we're going to see some of those generational aspects in both of their charts. So they're really important things in their charts that they would share with everyone their age. But what we're really looking at is how those configurations have impacted their personal planet.
I just want to point, just before we go, Jenny, one thing I found out is if you see it, the rating of this chart is DD. So I'm not sure if this is an actual time of birth. I think maybe that this might have been rectified by somebody.
Yeah, I grayed out the ascendant, the midheaven. Okay. I kind of put a bar around the moon because those we just don't know and we can't.
Yeah, we don't know. Okay.
Very much confidence on the house placements. But I would say pretty much however you slice it, we've got a grand cross here.
Yeah.
And that's so Saturn has now moved from Neptune's position to a square with Neptune. So they're still in relationship, and Pluto's making an even tighter square to that Neptune. We also have that Pluto's Saturn Chiron, which is has a lot of potential for psychic pain, directly opposite that Venus-Mars conjunction. And that, the Venus-Mars conjunction can really drive an inner urgency around the balance of the masculine and feminine, or the integration of those two sides. And we also have Ceres, the planet of grief, and a kind of a transforming loss in opposition to that Neptune and loosely Uranus. So, dear listener, you can easily see this chart online and pull it up on astro.com or somewhere else. But it basically, the details are less important than the fact that this is a grand cross with a tremendous amount of tension.
Yes.
Talk about holding the tension. This is like a pressure cooker creatively. And so, she worked so incredibly hard. She just not only had the genius and the fantasy. There's a difference between fantasy and daydreaming, staring at the ceiling, and actually doing the work to put this stuff into the physical realm. And so this is a transformational chamber, but it also can feel like a prison. Yeah. And I think it could also feel like being a little bit locked up. Nevertheless, there's something very strong in this chart, like what we saw in Jung's chart. The sun, radiant and strong, powerful in Leo, the bounds of Venus, artistic expression, and the moon also in its own sign, in Cancer. So there is some primal vitality in spite of her frailty, in spite of her disadvantages and intense trauma. There's a drive toward the life force.
Yeah, what I notice is, first of all, the story that you're referring to, which is, first of all, she has Saturn square Neptune, which is exactly the aspect that we were just talking about that Liz Green identified as being a person that needs to put the formless into form, and she certainly did that. So her work, because the Pluto and the Neptune are so wired in, is extremely, it brings those two elements so closely inside, the Neptune, the otherworldliness, the unconscious, and the Pluto, which is this compulsive underworld feeling that you have reading Wuthering Heights. You feel like there is darkness, you know, in the way that Pluto can bring. But the other thing I notice is, and I've noticed this in other charts, that what she has and her brilliance, I think, is also seen through the Uranus trine Mercury. She has it was probably very easy for her. She was very young when she was doing this, and yet she shows tremendous maturity in the writing style, in what she can access, which is not that easy, and then communicating that in a creative way. And Mercury in Leo is extremely creative, the ability to bring
a very different way, a way that nobody can do it. That Neptune is also hanging out, you know, round about the midpoint of Jupiter Uranus,
right?
So that, and we'll see that Jupiter Uranus showing up in other charts here, and that just the innovation that's coming through. And the Jupiter's working well for her in aspect to her moon, and that, you know, helps her with her education. Mm-hmm. Possibly that Uranus Mercury has to do with that unorthodox education that she receives. Go ahead.
I was just going to mention that I also think that the Venus conjunct Mars is very interesting, disposited or ruled by that Mercury in Leo. She really is writing a story. It's a quaternity. There are four characters that, you know, at the beginning you do have the Catherine and Heathcliff, and then you go to the next generation where the conflict is actually resolved. And I think what's interesting is her feminine marker, the emotional, the Venus, is conjunct at the same place as the Mars. She did actually integrate those two, which Barbara Hannah in her book, The On the Animus, says that's like a lifelong work. That's the thing we spend our entire lives. And here she is, very young, is able to bring these two together. Had she not had that second part of the novel with Hareton and the young Catherine, I think you would have said it's unfinished. It didn't, but somehow she managed to resolve that with the next generation coming together. And I think that's what the brilliance about this novel, that it doesn't leave you just with the story of Catherine and Heathcliff, that there is some sort of resolution using the four characters.
Shedd talks about that, doesn't he? He talks about the two-stage healing.
Yes.
That shows up in fairy tales and in human lives, where there's sort of this, we can think of Catherine and Heathcliff as that first stage, or the lesser conjunctio, where there is this attempt, or even in the Psyche and Eros story, Kalshen talks about, you know, there's that kind of dreamy first phase of Psyche and Eros, where they're together in the cave and they're making love and they're, you know, happy, but she's not allowed to look at him.
Yeah.
And that gets shattered, and that work has to be now done for real.
Right. And that is actually the most important part of that myth. And actually, there is a little bit of a resonance here, too, with although it doesn't happen again in the first generation. They can't really see each other as real the way that then in the second generation you see. But in Psyche and Eros, the critical thing is the sisters are actually the springboard for her individuation, because they force her to look. When you're unconscious, you're not looking, you're not having a real relationship. You're having a relationship with whatever you have in your head. And I think that's what's brilliant about that particular myth, that eventually she must come to terms through trial and tribulation and discernment and everything that is thrown on her by Aphrodite. She has to see what is actually there, as opposed to living in the darkness where everything is extremely nebulous. And I think this novel, again, in particular, more so than I think than Jane Eyre. I think this is a much more sophisticated work than Jane Eyre, in my view, for that reason, that in the second half, you get this more realistic integration of these two, the male and the female, through Hareton and Catherine.
Yeah, the daemon, or that persecutory, highly reactive, dangerous protector, can become actually the helper, or it can get... It gets a real job to do.
Yes. And I think what's interesting about Heathcliff is he's a terrible character in the second half. He's abusive, just as he's been abused. But he has this pocket of compassion for Hareton, for Hindley's son, the Hindley who is his, you know, arch enemy. And yet he's able to see himself in that. And so he's not completely lost. There is something about him that is... has some redemption in it, which I think is interesting, again, from her perspective, having created this. Again, so young, I'm in full admiration for having for an author who is able to create this kind of a story that has such great impact.
I wonder if she I saw somewhere that, she really worked on the plotting of this, and there were notes, and it's like, I wonder if it was all figured out in her mind and then she wrote it, or if she had to feel her way forward in, through revision, as a writer. It's like you have to feel your way through the things that aren't working. And it comes to such a perfect ending with Catherine and Heath. Catherine Heathcliff is haunted and has actually ordered her, basically to haunt him to death and out of this world. And
Right. Well, he
that's very
does.
true too. It's like earlier in the story, he's actually literally digging up her grave
Right,
and
right.
looking into her. So they're united in the after world, in the shadow world, the next generation united in this world. And you feel that they are in this, second stage or this greater conjunctio, that there will be a birth, that there will be a healing, that there
Yes.
will be a child. And
And it's interesting because we often talk about it, and I think Kalshad speaks about this, how, and you certainly see it in classical Greek works, that the what we're looking for is a member of the generation to heal the family wound. That there has to be an Orestes, this is an Aeschylus, there has to be someone that steps forth and says, I will not follow the pattern of abuse or whatever the wound is in the family. I take it on and I will resolve it. And I just, looking at Emily Brontë's chart, she has Chiron very much wired into this chart, into the Saturn and the Pluto. And I have a feeling she is resolving not only I'm gonna take a step here, not only a family wound, but perhaps a collective unconscious wound, something that is lying there that has to be brought out. And this is why, when you say about that this was this a work that had to be super edited, when I read it, I get the feeling of somebody who had just this explosion of creative energy, and the story came out, and that it kind of worked itself. And I wonder, I mean, maybe she did do a lot of editing, maybe not, but it seems that it was written in a very short period of time. And it strikes me as that's what has what's why it seems like a visionary work, something that was extracted from the unconscious and just came together through her Saturn, because Saturn has to track structure, or the thing wouldn't make sense. So there's this incredibly well done coming together of all the elements, and I think that's a Saturn work, but it just has this incredible visionary quality in me that she almost did not have control over it.
Yeah, Neptune trine V trine Mercury, it does. It seems like it's just erupting from the
Yes.
unknown. And with those powerful Leo planets, it's like, and it's so interesting that it's framed with this observer, this stranger who comes to hear the story. And so he's ostensibly narrating, but there's this lovely maternal figure, the maid, Nellie,
Nelly.
that actually providing the majority of the detail and the lay of the land and the intimate knowledge of these multiple generations. And so I feel that also these motherless children with, I think in some ways an emotionally inept father, that she's constructed for herself a loving mother that
Yes.
holds
Yes.
the
Yes.
storytelling. And where you would expect Lockwood, this traveler, the narrator, to kind of swoop in and solve everything by marrying Kathy, like that would be the Victorian,
Yeah.
kind of like magazine, fiction, short fiction ending. He's really he makes the decision to just go back to the world.
Yeah. This is a world that is too much for him. Interesting, you just mentioned, I didn't realize, but you're right. Lockwood and Nellie provide another male figure dyad. So you've got that Venus Mars again. She's putting this all across. And I think that's an important thing you just said, that these were children with whose mother died very young, that she died of uterine cancer, I think when she was 38. So these young people were without a mother. They did have an aunt, I think, living with them, but they were deprived of that mother figure, and they kind of created their own little world. And it is interesting that in both Jane Eyre and in Wuthering Heights, the mother figure doesn't seem to be around. It's missing. And of course, Jane Eyre, she's an orphan, but it's and
Multiple mothers. This,
yeah, that's true.
they're just frail. And there's also the aspect of illness, illness, and that people are overtaken to such an extent by their unconscious contents that they simply break apart and die. And Catherine's illness that takes her down begins as a narcissistic illness. Oh, look at me, I'm not eating. Oh, look at me, I'm all shut up in my room, suffering so badly. Won't you come and witness that? But it ends up killing her.
And actually, then it ends up killing Heathcliff too, because he sort of succumbs to the same thing years later, does not want to live. So he basically just, creates a situation where he dies. And that again is Neptune, the idea of being overtaken so much by the unconscious, which, by the way, Neptune is often the marker for addiction, does happen in addiction in many cases. And it happens anytime you are overwhelmed by contents you have no control over that are unstructured, which is why I think Saturn is really helpful for Neptune, right? That you have no way of finding them.
Like almost quasi-suicides in the story.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, at the same time she's writing this, they're watching their brother doing this with his addiction to alcohol and opium and his, you know, inability to show up in the world. Maybe this is where this was coming from, this inability to be able to help him, because it seems that Emily Brontë was particularly close to Branwell. And after he died, she's quoted as saying, I don't care, I will disappear as well. So there was something. It's almost what she was taking at her interior landscape. And maybe you think that she found a way to work with the same Neptune energy in a much more profitable way, shall we say, or something that didn't damage her as much by being able to. And this is why I think creative work is so powerful. She was able to take that longing and that interior world and put it to paper, put it into form, so it didn't haunt her quite the way that I think Branwell was haunted, because he had, you know, gave up being a painter, then gave up writing, even though he had this tremendous potential.
I look at that sun, which is at the bendings of the nodes. It's, you know, it's exactly at a 90-degree angle to the north and south lunar nodes, which are, they're kind of ghostly. I mean, they're different ways in different cultures, but often with a link to the idea of the soul's life, before and after death. And that can show up as a past life, you know, narrative, or as an ancestral. And I've seen that a lot in my practice, where it's like the themes that the family line is working with and chewing on over generations is often showing up there. And so when something's right at the 90-degree bending of the nodes, and hers is at the north bending, it can be an impetus for visibility and some energy that she's able to draw on for the ego to shine, to thrive, and to manifest. So that's interesting, you know, and especially with the Leo sun in the bounds of Venus. I like a Scorpio rising for Emily Brontë.
It works. It absolutely works, especially when you think about how interior her world is and how she was the one that really wanted to know. When they go off to the famous scene that is shown in Walking Invisible, which I highly recommend if you want to see a great sort of bio done, where they go to the publisher in London. It's the two sisters. Emily refuses to go. It's Charlotte and Anne that go off to prove that they're women and to prove to the publisher who they are. She refuses. And there's something about Emily that just, you could tell there's a, and that strikes me as that Scorpio rising would be fit, in that there is no way that she is going to do anything that she believes is not right for her in whatever way she's defined that.
If you pay attention to some people with intense Scorpio placements or Scorpio, sometimes there is this great stillness and this kind of refusal to interact on a Libran basis of, you know, what we're accustomed to in terms of cordiality and, you know, making small talk. And there is a refusal there. So anyway, if we do get that Scorpio rising, then that does put the sun in the 10th, which again makes it strengthens it in that angular high place, and in relationship to the nodes. I feel like that is her Roman candle.
Right. And also the ninth, being having the moon so strong and domicile in the ninth, would make sense from the perspective of how she impacted the publishing world, that just looking at it on the basic. The other thing that strikes me is that those nodes would be ruled by Venus, and the north node, the node that you usually associate with growth and development, is in the seventh house. What she created was the ultimate story of partnership, right? The coming together of that Venus Mars, which is together in her chart. So it does absolutely fit. And
a relational novel, and Jupiter in the third, you know, with the great blessing of the siblings and the sibling society and creativity.
Yeah.
So then that Jupiter would then become is the ruler of the Saturn Chiron Pluto.
Right. And actually so makes sense, because I still think of that wonderful scene of them sitting around a dining room table and reading stories to each other, you know, just having so many, it is so rare to have that many siblings be so talented and feed off each other, you know?
Isn't there an imaginary world called Angria?
Angria, yes.
I love that. It's like, you know, the rage of these poor children who've lost their mother and the infantile rage. And, you know,
Yes.
it's so great. And yeah. And C.S. Lewis, you know, also lost his mother at a very early age. And he and his brother, Warney, created, you know, maps and this whole imaginary world called Boxen. And he was never able to share that, you know, with the mother that would.
And that actually strikes me, that's Tolkien's story too. Didn't he lose his mother? I think at 12. Again, you have this sense of creating your own maternal, maybe environment, so that you, in the case of this, it was all creativity. It was all a way of getting together and creating this imaginal world. And I keep thinking of, because if you see these video or photographs of where they were raised, it was so isolated that you're almost creating these, and almost maybe that's what you need, and for this kind of work to come out, the fact that there isn't an outer world to distract you means you do have to turn into the inner world, which makes me think of, what are we doing to children today when they're being bombarded from the outer world constantly, right, without giving them a chance to. I had a professor who I adored, and as an undergraduate, who would make his kids, and the kids, two of them ended up to be Jung, ended up being Jungian analysts, which I thought was interesting. But he would make his kids go up and sit in a room by themselves from 12 to 4 and be creative. So I just want you to go up there. And, you know, this is quite a while ago, because he said that's where the real work happened. And he understood that. He was a literature prof, and they would do that. And they talk about how this was the most important moment of their days for them, because they would go around singing or painting, or, but they were alone, and he felt that this was something they needed to do. And this was the world they lived in. These three, they had each other, but the outside world just was not that present to them.
Right. And so the role of the moors and the heathland that surrounds the place, and that's even encoded in Heathcliff's name, the wildness
Yes.
instinct.
Yes.
And that becomes, in a way, the protective form of the numinous that rises up around their souls, where they
Right.
are able to feel, in some sense, that they're in contact with something magical and something
Right.
good.
I also think that the environment they're in is so reflective of their inner worlds too. They do not have easy inner worlds. They're very turbulent. Anybody who can create, so they're so fascinating because of it. There's so much opposition and so much creativity and so much that it makes sense that it would come out of that landscape. It's often said that they reflected that landscape so well, the emotional landscape so matches the exterior landscape.
Yes, I'm looking now at the, you know, at the moon as geography, the moon in the chart as place, as home.
Right.
And again, it's really dignified, and the different parsonages that they lived in, and the land surrounding them, that on one side it would go down to the town, and on the other side it would go up into the wild world.
Right.
And it seemed like they were always going that direction. They weren't going.
They're not interested in the relationship, especially Emily, I think, because we've talked about Emily and her work being particularly visionary. She seems to be the one that was most likely, or most drawn to that landscape. And I think describes it quite powerfully.
That Jupiter aspect of the moon is like, here's your gift, here's your protection, the
Yes.
land. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, by the way, is a form of mother too. The environment can become that. The earth, what you're relating to, it's a form that can give you a sense of connection to some sort of mother archetype.
Oh, absolutely.
So
Absolutely.
then we look at this, the publication date of the book, and it's so, to me, I mean, you've marked exactly what I noticed, which is, this is a Venus-Pluto book in many ways. Also, Uranus involved, but I think the Venus-Pluto really, really jumps out at you no matter what,
it's
right?
22 Libra Venus to 25 Aries
It's
Pluto.
there. Yeah.
Wow, it is very powerful, and it's in a T-square there with Jupiter.
Jupiter, yeah.
But what's Jupiter's more tightly aspecting is Uranus. So that creativity and the breakthrough format of the artwork is there in the Jupiter Uranus period of, you know,
Right.
and also I think Jane Eyre is published just 3 months, within 3 months.
They're all there. Well, what's interesting to me from this perspective is just she seems to have brought out that archetypal story for the world. So she's channeling that Venus Pluto story that I think needed to be heard or wouldn't show up. I often wonder if, artists, the way I look at them is they're channeling something that the collective needs to hear. And if they're true visionary artists, they're picking something that is at the right time. Maybe this book had it been written 100 years before, it would not have gotten anywhere because, and maybe could not have been written before. I think of the first novel published in the English language being Pamela, and how different by Samuel Richardson, and how different this is from Wuthering Heights, one being so caught up in virtue, and this one totally not interested in virtue. It's the opposite. It's about how emotions are so much more important than the societal ideas you may have.
What I'm realizing, Bea, as I look at this is not Ceres. This is Black Moon Lilith that
Oh,
you threw
taboo.
up.
Yeah.
Black Moon Lilith, just like,
Yes, it is. No, that's what
that's
I have
even,
there. Yeah, it is Black Moon
and
Lilith.
conjunct the Venus. So it's, again, it's about the deep instinctual reality. What's untamed. What is deeply potent? What has been, and also, what's the lost part of the feminine that we're all in
Yeah,
search of and
right.
badly lack of? Yeah, it's really configured there exactly opposite Uranus. So this is like an explosion of
Yes, it really is. I
that
mean,
instinct.
this it is, but
What
yet at the
is
same
in the
time, it's
world?
nicely trying that Neptune. So she's bringing in the unconscious in a way that is integrated in a weird way. You're getting a sense of a direct line into the unconscious, but my God, you're finding the Pluto there. You're finding that Uranus there. It's an intense, intense, and you're finding, yeah, you're right, Black Lilith, which I.
Wild. It's crazy and just uncivilized. It's terrifying book to read.
Yeah, even today, isn't that funny? We're exposed to so many things, and yet you read it and you go, whoa, this, and you're still really, there's something about it. I don't know how men feel about this. I haven't really talked to men about this, but women are very, find this story very compelling, very compelling. And that's why there's so many versions of it out there in the world, and it keeps being remade.
Recognizable. It's so recognizable. And look at this exact square, partile square of Neptune to Mercury,
Yes.
which degree. So the authorship is unknown. There's a little bit of a lie here when it comes,
Interesting. Because that's an exact square. Yeah, so there was the even the lie, because they knew that women weren't allowed to have, and this is why these women are so groundbreaking. They weren't allowed to have those kinds of emotions and those kinds of stories until they revealed themselves to be who they were, and then it was accepted. So they're groundbreaking not only in the nature of the work, but that they allowed women to have a life that goes beyond the, Jane Austen's wonderful. I'm a huge fan of Jane Austen, but it's very, very measured, comparatively. You don't get these grand, basically it's like a storm versus an organized tea party in some way. I mean, there's still a lot of emotion in Jane
No wonder
Austen.
it's totally punk rock compared
Yes. Yes, I like that comparison. Yes.
to Pride and Prejudice. And then we just have the death chart here. It was so poignant to see that
Yeah.
this that she what Emily died during her Saturn return. So the
Yeah.
book published and her death were basically her Saturn return time, and the
Yeah.
pattern is just coming and because when you're looking at someone's Saturn return, okay, well, what's the condition of this Saturn in the root chart?
Yeah.
This Saturn is this is a tough one. This is
Yeah.
conjunct Chiron and Pluto. So yeah, this I think this Saturn return took out a lot of people in her generation.
Well, I'm good. Yeah. I mean, her brother, I guess, would have died just shortly after. He died at 31. He would have died shortly after his Saturn return. And Anne couldn't, I think she must have, I didn't put that chart, but she died shortly after Emily. So they were all pretty close together in age. So yeah, no, it took out a lot of them. But you're right about the root chart. The Saturn is conjunct the Neptune, sorry, the Pluto, which means that that's a difficult return.
Did she die of tuberculosis or
She
what?
did. The three of them died of tuberculosis. And for a long time, it was thought that Charlotte also died. It wasn't until this medical historian at the University of London reviewed it and said, no, this was death. She basically was not treated properly early in pregnancy when she had this awful, there's the name, and I'm completely drawing a blank. Hyperium gravidarum. I can't remember the first word, but it is, you have to be treated, and it wasn't caught. But yeah, the other three died one after the other of TB, which was, of course, killed a lot of people in that time period. So But it was particularly tragic. And the real tragic story here is the father who outlived all his six children and died at 84. And you think, oh my Lord, this man, he outlived every one of them, which I think probably wasn't all that unusual then, right? But still, oof, it's a crazy story. Yeah.
But in the death chart here, we do one bright spot here is seeing that on the day of her death, Jupiter was on her Mercury, and her Mercury, her identity as a writer and her writings, they are crowned by Jupiter.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
This is the, you know, the great success and what will live on from her lifetime is that powerful Mercury in Leo.
It's also interesting that the Jupiter often signals, you see it often in death charts as a form of release. You know, you find it there. It's an interesting thing. Lots of people say, well, Jupiter is a very positive. Yeah, but it also, for many people who are sick, it actually spells a relief from that confinement in a body that is painful.
Yes, because here in Charlotte's death chart, we have Jupiter going over the Saturn-Moon conjunction. And I thought,
Right.
Oh, that's release, you know, from the heaviness.
Right, right. And she had Pluto, of course, conjunct the by transit, she had Pluto conjunct the natal sun, which is another marker, obviously, for, but Jupiter being involved in both cases, it is a release of some sort, often because the pain of being in the body is too strong.
Knowing what you told me about her pregnancy, you know, Jupiter over that Saturn moon too, it was like, you know, the kind of overcoming by the pregnancy.
Yeah. Yeah,
or
she was.
The Saturn moon in the natal chart is showing us that pregnancy is going to be a problem.
It's going to be a problem. Yeah, it also shows, by the way, I mean, Charlotte was considered the kind of the most difficult of the three. The Saturn moon that she carried around. Now, we don't, again, know if this is right time of birth. So it could be, you know, we don't know this, how close that Saturn was to that moon, but it would be somewhere, you know, within 13 degrees.
Yeah, it would be what's called in concourse. So
yeah, yeah.
Classical.
So, They would definitely be in conversations, I would say. And so to me, it's like this, I just get the feeling that she would have felt the loss of the mother in a specific way, you know, and maybe that's why Jane Eyre shows up as the story of an orphan. It just seems the Saturn moon can be very difficult sometimes in that regard. But yeah, then the Jupiter comes in. Certainly she was the only one who ever married and then, you know, died shortly after. I think it was 9 months after her marriage, pregnant. So.
We also see herself as with the Saturn moon as having to grow up really young. And you see this non-girl who's lost the mother and is now raising three younger children as a little mother. So that's the gravity and the duty that's imposed on her.
Which is often a Saturn moon story. The idea that you are sometimes parent to a parent, that could be one way, or that you have to take responsibility way too early so you don't get the chance to be a child. And she's often portrayed as kind of a, you know, strict, not very pleasant person. And I wonder how much of that would have been due to the fact that she was an old person, a young person's body from very young, right? So it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Saturn ruled moon. Yeah, and then which is something you said about the you know, that because the brother Bramwell was not able to live out his potential, that also might have felt like a family duty.
Yes, it does. And a bit of a curse for Bramwell, because there's a bit of, if you read some of what's been written, and of course we don't know, there was the first original biography by the Mrs. Askell, and that's been sort of you know, put aside, but there seems to be some idea that he was resentful about the fact that they had published. I'm not quite sure if he knew or what he knew, because he seemed to be very much in his own world. But the other thing I've read, which is interesting, is how both the parents were also sort of amateur poets, and that they also were living out the unlived potential in the, you know, Jung often talks about how the next generation often lives out the unlived life of the parents. And the Methodist mother was writing some poetry, which is very, you know, very religious, and she died obviously quite young. So you're seeing a kind of family. Yeah.
We're over her letters, and that's what they had left from their mother was writing.
That's it. They're taking
But you know, they must have been so mad at Bramwell, because the whole idea was like he got a much better education formally than they did, with the idea that he was going to support them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he went to the dogs, and then, you know, that, so maybe publishing these novels was like a big F you, Bramwell.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's a good way to look at it, because remember, I don't know, did you see Walking Invisible? There's this whole scene where the sisters are, and especially Emily, because she was particularly close to Bramwell, are particularly emphatic that he should never find out that they're writing these things and sending it off to the publisher, and they have to keep themselves hidden, not only from the world, but even within their own family. That at one point they've finally confessed to the father that, you know, she says, I am the Charlotte says, I am the author of Jane Eyre. He can hardly believe it. But then the reason she's confessing is to say, we can take care of ourselves. We don't have to be married. We don't need our brother, who's obviously not going to take care of us. And so it was a way of, yes, this is the King Guarantee, which is so interesting because if you remember, that was Jane Austen's problem. This is a problem across the 19th century. If you're not married, the woman is really at risk. There's no way that she has to support herself somehow. And so they found a way.
Well, you know, Joe has to get out there and make money for her.
Yeah.
Really, but that's extraordinary. No, I didn't know that. And that now shines another light on Charlotte's destruction of Emily's second novel. Maybe it was too, would have been too much for the father to bear.
Could be. Yeah. I mean, what I've read is that she thought it was too intense. And I wonder what she meant by intense. Could it have been too sexual? Could it have been too, I don't know what she saw there. But again, that is Charlotte's, that's the worst thing she could have ever have done. And it's really a pity. It's not the first time we've seen disappearing books that make us all feel, you know, but that's a particularly tragic one.
It certainly is. We can only wonder.
So what I'm going to do, Jenny, is I'm going to post links to the charts that we've been discussing on AstroSeek so people can, if they want to look at them, can go actually look at what we've been discussing. Because I think visually it's good to just take a look at it. But I thought when I finally went to look at these and you know, looking through the material, how well their charts represent what they brought out into the world, what we have, which is their record. I mean, we don't know really anything about them beyond their work. And I always say, and I'll leave people with this and see what you want to end this with, but I think when people talk about, oh, I need the biography of this author or that author or this artist, I think their biography is their work. If you can look at their work, you get a sense of what their inner world was like. And that's really what we need. The rest of it is, yes, we can contextualize it. They were born here. They're very interesting, but really their true essence is in what they produce. But not all artists are able to produce such a clear picture of their inner world. And I think this, going back to Jung's idea of visionary artists versus the psychological artists, I think that's what makes Emily Bronte in particular so powerful, that this is a clear, direct line into an inner world that you rarely see. It's hard to get that.
Yeah, it's very extraordinary. And I think that for anybody who's born with a Grand Cross or has a Grand Cross, I think this is a tremendously inspiring picture of the product of holding that kind of tension and how oftentimes mastery, even T-squares, can produce this kind of mastery because of the need to stand in the middle of these conflicting forces and synthesize and alchemize them into something great.
It's interesting, you know, just before we go, in the latest interview with Rick Tarnas, that Chris Brennan did, Tarnas says something that I think is very important to remind people. It is the squares, the difficult aspects, the unintegrated aspects that are really the drivers for our greatest growth. And that if you've lived with them long enough, now this is an extraordinary case. She was young. She lived with it a very short time. She was able to hold the tension of the opposites. But if you live long enough, you will be able to integrate them in such a way that you can become a master at it. And so I tend to look at and a lot of people, I think, share my view that they're actually gifts in disguise, but you really have to be willing to sit in the fire. And as Von Franz used to say about men, you know, you have to, the animal will make you sit in the fire and roast a bit before she yields her treasures. And I think this is the case for these aspects. You really have to be willing, and you must, because there's no way out of it, to hold that tension and see, well, what can come out of it.
Yeah. Wonderful. It's great talking to you, Bea.
Great talking to you as well, Jenny. Looking forward to the next time. Thanks for listening. If you would like to support our podcast and you like what you're hearing, please go over to any of the places where you download it and leave a review. That helps other people find us. To find us personally, you can find me at sophiacycles.com, and you can find Jenny Montgomery at jenny-montgomery.com. Links are all in the show notes. Until next time.